So let's begin our sit, just settling back into a comfortable meditation posture, whatever that is for you, whatever really supports you being relaxed and alert, being present. You can close your eyes or just lower your gaze, taking your attention out of the visual world and turning then more towards the felt experience of the inner world, the body, the emotions. And as we turn inward, first just seeing how you're holding your body. Is there any tension, stress that's in the body? You might take some deeper breaths and release, having a sense of letting go in the body. It can be helpful to move the attention through the body, sort of piece by piece, the head and shoulders, chest and belly, arms and legs. You may find that there is some stress that doesn't just fall away when you try to relax. In our daily lives, we can accumulate this kind of ball of tight energy in the body. Might feel it in the chest or the belly, maybe in the jaw. Really can show up anywhere, the neck or shoulders. And when we start to meditate, it becomes apparent that there's this tension. And so we might or to try to breathe into it or relax it. And maybe it dissolves then. That can be a real sense of release, of relief, just letting go. But it's also possible that some of these sensations or energies really are a little more tightly embedded. So even as we try to soften, they stay resistant. And with energies like this, with sensations like this, we need to bring a certain kind of acceptance and kindness to ourselves, or even compassion. Just acknowledging that life brings these tensions. It's not some flaw in our personalities that makes us tense or stressed. Our life itself is challenging. This is dukkha. This is what the Buddha tells us. So with these more stubborn energies, we try to bring understanding and acceptance. It's okay. Not the way we would like it to be, but okay. Manageable. This relationship to these experiences is really important. Do we build a story around them, a negative story, a judgmental story, or fearful or resistant? Or can we have openness and just normalize these challenges? It's really, this attitude makes all the difference. Really makes the difference between suffering and not suffering. How we relate to the difficulties. And then in that process, we keep coming back to the breath. So that we're not just focusing on the difficult sensations, or seeing that they're there, or accepting. And then we're coming back. Just coming back to the simple experience of breathing. And over time, with this non-resistance and this mindfulness, there can be a shift, a nice settling. So try to be patient, especially at the beginning of a period of meditation. Just stick with the process. Try to keep it simple. mindfulness of the breath. This is what the Buddha said was his own practice. We need to understand that this doesn't mean trying to push everything away except the breath. We're not trying to grasp onto the breath and cling to it tightly. It's much more natural than that, just feeling yourself breathing in this larger space of your mind. So that space includes sounds and sensations, and thoughts and feelings. And sometimes we get diverted into one of those things, especially thoughts. When you notice that, I want to be very gentle and really accepting again that that's happening as we bring ourselves back to the breath. That moment of recognizing that we're lost in thoughts. It's a critical moment, how we respond to that. We start getting frustrated, judging ourselves, irritated, we just create more problems. Rather, it's more of a moment to shrug, say, oh, thoughts again, okay. Not surprising, not a problem, just come back. So a very friendly attitude towards our mind. All right. So, good morning to those for whom it is morning. We have any of our European friends, good evening. We are in step 12, 20 months into this story. And I've been talking a lot about spiritual awakening and all of that. I think it's so it's one of the areas, certainly in Buddhism, the topic of enlightenment, and I would say in recovery, the idea of spiritual awakening, step 12 says, that can really get the mind going. So maybe we'll get the mind going some more this morning. So I'm going to read a little bit from One Breath at a Time, and then I'm going to read a little bit from Jack Kornfield. This is from a section called Measuring Up on page 254 for those who are following along. It starts by talking about the idea that there are these different views about what enlightenment is. And then I say, some people use the contradictory descriptions of enlightenment as justification to dismiss the whole notion. Others say that the experience itself is conditioned by the archetypal religious symbols we carry in our subconscious. One Zen saying is, what makes you think you will know when you are enlightened? As though the experience itself might be unrecognizable. There's a certain logic to this. Very often as we are transformed, we can't see it happening. The same could be true of enlightenment. Another saying is, now that I'm enlightened, I'm as miserable as ever. One of my favorites. Implying that enlightenment doesn't fix all our problems. Perhaps what we call enlightenment affects us only on a certain level, what we call spiritual, but doesn't necessarily have a direct effect on our, quote, real lives. This makes a certain amount of sense too. Let me just read this piece from some of this from Jack Kornfield. So I've mentioned this a couple times recently. It's an essay, actually appeared in Inquiring Mind magazine first, which is I'm gonna put the URL. It's Inquiring Mind. I think it's .com. Let's see. it's a Buddhist magazine that's now defunct, but they've managed to put, I think they've digitized it all. It's inquiringmind.com. And I actually was a guest editor on a couple of issues. It's a great magazine. It was around for about 30 years. In any case, this article first appeared in there in 2010, and it's called Enlightenments, plural. And the part I want to read is towards the end. It's called Expressions of Enlightenment. So this is from Jack Kornfield, and it's been republished in his book called Bringing Home the Dharma, which is from Shambhala. So this section is called Expressions of Enlightenment. Whatever our gate to enlightenment, the first real taste, stream entry, is followed by many more tastes as we learn to stabilize, deepen, and embody this wisdom in our own unique life. What does it look like? The facets of enlightenment express themselves marvelously in our teachers. Each manifests enlightenment with his or her own flavors. Deepa Ma, the wonderful grandmother in Calcutta, who was one of our great masters, was a tiny person with a powerfully trained mind. Deepa Ma expressed enlightenment as love. She devotedly instructed her students in mindfulness and loving kindness, and then she hugged them, putting her hands on their head, face, and shoulders, whispering metta phrases. They got drunk on love. Like Deepa Ma, Amachi, a Hindu teacher from South India, manifests enlightenment as the hugging guru. She goes into a trance, and all night long she holds people. She might take as many as 2,000 people onto her lap and hug them. This is enlightenment as love. For Zen Master Suzuki Roshi, enlightenment was expressed by being just where you are. A woman told Suzuki Roshi she found it difficult to mix Zen practice with the demands of being a householder. I feel I am trying to climb a ladder, but for every step upward, I slip backward 2 steps. Forget the ladder, Suzuki Roshi told her. When you awaken, everything is right here on the ground. He explained how the desire to gain anything means you miss the reality of the present. Quote, when you realize the truth that everything changes and find your composure in it, there you find yourself in nirvana, unquote. Asked further about enlightenment, Suzuki Roshi said, strictly speaking, there are no enlightened beings. There is only enlightened activity. If you think you're enlightened, that is not it. The goal is to let go of being anyone special and meet each moment with beginner's mind. Mahasi Sayadaw, the Burmese master, expressed enlightenment as emptiness. Watching him on his visits to America, we saw that he rarely laughed or judged. Instead, he exuded a quiet equanimity. Events and conversations would happen around him while he remained still. He was like space, transparent, nobody there. This is enlightenment as emptiness. For Ajahn Jumnian, a Thai forest master, awakening is not only empty, it's full. His robe is covered in hundreds of sacred medallions, and he employs dozens of skillful means to teach: guided meditations, sacred chants, mantras, chakra and energy practices, forest medicines, animal stories, and shamanic rituals. His dharma is all ours, nonstop, full of life and joy. There's a sense of abundance in him, and happiness just pours out like a fountain. He expresses enlightenment as fullness. Thich Nhat Hanh expresses enlightenment as mindfulness. When he has come to teach at Spirit Rock, 2,000 people sit meditatively on the hillside and eat their apples mindfully in preparation for his arrival. A bell is rung and he walks slowly and deliberately up the road, so mindfully that everyone sighs, ah. The consciousness of 2,000 people is transformed just seeing this man walk, each step, the whole universe. As we watch, we drop into the reality of the eternal present. This is where we awaken, enlightenment as mindfulness. The Dalai Lama expresses enlightenment as compassionate blessing. For instance, once at the end of his stay at a San Francisco hotel, he asked the management to bring out all the employees. This meant the people who chop vegetables in the kitchen, who clean the carpets late at night, who make the beds. The big circular driveway filled with all those who made this hotel work, but who were usually unrecognized. One by one, he looked at each one with full presence, took each person's hand and said, thank you, moving unhurriedly just to make sure that he connected with each one fully. The Dalai Lama personifies enlightenment as compassionate blessing. Ajahn Chah's manifestation was the laughter of wisdom. Whether with generals or ministers, farmers or cooks, he would say, when I see how much people are struggling, I look at them with great sympathy and ask, are you suffering? Ah, you must be very attached. Why not let go? His teachings were deep and straight to the point. He'd say, if you let go a little, you'll be a little happy. If you let go a lot, you'll be a lot happy. If you let go completely, you'll be completely happy. He saw suffering, its cause, and that freedom and that freedom is possible in any moment. He expressed enlightenment as wisdom. When people read these stories, they might ask, how do they relate to me? I want these enlightenments. How do I get them? What should I do? The jewel of enlightenment invites us to awaken through many skillful means. Mahasi Sayadaw would say, to find emptiness, note every single moment until what you think to be the world dissolves and you will come to know freedom. Ajahn Chah would say, just let go and become the awareness. Be the one who knows. Dipa Ma would say, love no matter what. Thich Nhat Hanh would say, rest in mindfulness, this moment, this eternal present. Ajahn Jumnyan would say, be happy for no cause. Suzuki Roshi would say, just be exactly where you are. Instead of waiting for the bus, realize you are on the bus. So is enlightenment a myth? No, it is not far away. It is freedom here and now to be tasted whenever you open to it. As you can see from the chapters in this book, enlightenment is available in every part of life. As a teacher, I have the privilege of seeing the blessing of enlightenments awaken in so many meditators who come to Dharma practice and become transformed through its many expressions. From initial tension and struggle with life, doubt, and distress, I watch their bodies ease, their faces soften, their Dharma vision open, their hearts blossom. From everyday nirvana to a deep purity of mind, they experience a taste of liberation directly. The Buddha declares, if it were not possible to free the heart from entanglement, I would not teach you to do so. Just because it is possible to free the heart, there arise the teachings of the Dharma of liberation offered open-handedly for the welfare of all beings. Aim for nothing less. So I really like that. I just think it, you know, it's sort of asking us to find out, ask ourselves, what is my manifestation of enlightenment? You know, and again, maybe enlightenment's too strong a word, but, you know, seeing that we don't have to fit ourselves into some model, you know, that we can you know, discover something that's maybe unique to us. Not what we usually think, because we sort of think, oh, I have to be somebody different, you know. And, you know, that's one of the mistakes of spiritual practice, is thinking that we have to become somebody different to be worthy or to be awakened. But, you know, that Suzuki Roshi kind of just, you know, be who you are, you know. You know, and I mean, obviously there's, that has to be understood in the context of a, you know, well, I'll just put the most simple terms in a moral context. We can, you know, being who we are doesn't mean that we don't need to be kind, and that we need to, it doesn't mean that we get to, you know, avoid the karmic consequences of our actions. So maybe, I guess, I don't even like this, but I'll say it anyway. You know, be the best that we could be, you know, or be our better selves, you know, and try to, you know, cultivate that. What, you know, the Buddhist path is, you know, described as these three stages that, of sila, samadhi, panya. The sila is the morality. It's around our behavior. That's, you know, what the first thing, this addicts that we had to deal with, And you know, that lays the foundation then in the Buddhist model for training the mind. So it's like train the body, train the mind, which is the samadhi part, the meditative part. And then panya is the wisdom. But they're not, it's not linear and they're not separate. You know, they all operate together. So that's why I say, like, you know, step one can be is a spiritual awakening, you know, just letting go on that profound level of our addiction is an awakening. And I do feel like there's many, well, I mean, I love the spirit of recovery that has this kind of essence of spiritual awakening that doesn't look like religious, and it doesn't look like some model. It's like, you know, you can meet people in 12-step meetings that are just ordinary people who you come to recognize have something, an inner glow, and as well as an outer expression of love and service and wisdom that's so powerful. And they're not gurus, and they're not, you know, they're just ordinary people. So, you know, this idea, I think it's important for us to all see that this idea of spiritual awakening is real for each of us. You know, I describe, I think, the next paragraph in my own book that I stopped, or I stopped reading, was when my sponsor, my former sponsor, I mean, you know, he was my sponsor for 18 years. That was, seemed like enough. But anyway, when he would read the 12 steps in a meeting, when he would read step 12, he would say, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, you know, I never asked him why he said it that way, but I took it to mean two things. And that's what I say in the book, that it meant that it's the only guaranteed result. Like, we're not really guaranteeing that you're gonna find romance and, you know, the, you know, fame or money. You know, we're guaranteeing that you do these steps, the result will be a spiritual awakening, which can be disappointing for people who want other stuff, but you can deal with that on your own time. But I'd also implied that that's no matter what, if you work these steps, it's going to happen. It's a spiritual awakening. So I think that sometimes we have to, that's kind of what I'm pointing to here, is like, we have to ask ourselves, what has been my spiritual awakening? How am I manifesting the spiritual awakening? Which, you know, can be hard for us to look at ourselves in that kind of positive way. It's always one of the issues. You know, it's like easy to write your inventory about how bad you are, but is there some way in which you feel or know that there's been an awakening? And part of that, as I say, is kind of demystifying the idea of awakening and taking it out of the sort of lofty ideas of you know, floating around in bliss, just seeing that it can be something very simple. So interesting to spend, you know, it's been like a week or two of kind of circling around this idea of spiritual awakening. And as I say, the sutta study class yesterday, we got into it as well. And there we were talking more about the technical aspects, you know, in the Theravadin version of enlightenment. But yeah. it's good to focus on this now and then. It's not something I think you want to spend all your time thinking about, but really valuable to just look for these positive manifestations of your recovery work and your spiritual work. So, I think that's enough to get, I hope, to get things, maybe conversation started this morning. We have a little bit of time. I am going to have to leave pretty much on time today, but I have about 15 minutes. So if anybody wants to chime in with a comment or question, happy to hear from you. Did I see, Jim, did you put your hand up there? Somebody, yeah, go for it.
Thanks, Kevin. really enjoyed the meditation and what you read. I love that part from Jack Kornfield. And I've sat with some of those teachers, Ajahn Jumi. It's really, just exudes joy.
Yeah.
And but anyway, I just finished a 9-day retreat with Bhikkhu and Alio on mindfulness of breathing. Mm-hmm. Anapanasati. Mm-hmm. And it has 16 steps to it. And the last step is letting go. And, you know, when you were talking about enlightenment and describing these different teachers, it just sort of had a little enlightenment moment of, you know, I always think of enlightenment as dealing with light, you know, and there are these different nimittas, I think they're called, signs in meditation practice. But also think of enlightenment as lightening your load, you know, letting go of, and it was you, you talked about it in your meditation, you know, letting go of these ideas of these judgments about ourselves or being hard on ourselves or these self views or, so I kind of like that picture of enlightenment of just being lighter, you know, dropping off.
Yeah.
Instead of trying to get something,
yeah.
You know.
You know, Jim, when I'm on retreat and I'm really working hard, you know, trying to really get, and my practice is really deepening. That's the edge that I try to work, is like, just keep letting go. And then it becomes a case of actually trying to find, where am I holding on? When it's like, there aren't really any thoughts here. And I've gotten to a place where, okay, thoughts are pretty much just out the window. And I'm just sitting here, but it's like I detect this tiny little fist. It's a very tiny little fist that's like right somewhere around my solar plexus or something. And it's, I don't really think it's physical. It's like the last clinging, you know? And so, yeah, letting go. It's just, it keeps the practice so simple that way, you know, because it can get into this whole like, oh, I need to do this, I need to do that, you know, oh, I need to investigate impermanence, or I need to investigate self, or, you know, and I'm all this kind of doing. And it's like, if I just keep letting go, because sometimes I just feel like I don't know what to do, you know, it's like too hard to get enlightened. So if I just keep letting go, maybe it'll figure itself out, you know?
And, you know, there's the monkey trap, you know, where the monkey grabs onto the, whatever it is, banana,
yeah,
and they get trapped because they won't let go.
Yeah.
their fist is stuck in the trap.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. That's always a great image. You know, but oh yeah. So I'm getting a call from my dentist and I have to take this. I'm sorry. Hold on. Merge. Okay. Sorry about that, but you know, teeth are really important, it turns out. who knew? If we'd have only known that when we were children, if they'd have only had fluoride when I was, you know, five. Anyway, I wanted to say that just this word enlightenment, you know, the weird thing, of course, it's really coming out of the Western tradition, you know, 18th century tradition. And it's that then the Victorians who translated the Pali, you know, to adopt this word. And as usual, like we're really, you know, interestingly, because it's, as you said, it's got the word light in it, you know, Nirvana, or Nibbana in Pali, apparently means something more like a fire that has gone out, which is in an odd way, almost the opposite, right? It's like the light has gone out. I've never thought of it particularly until this moment, making that kind of reverse connection. But that image is definitely one of letting go, the light, the fire that's gone out. It's like, there's nothing there. You know, what is it? It's just the end of that fire. So interesting just to, well, play around a little bit with that. Okay, Steve, hi.
Good morning, Kevin. Yeah, you brought up the teeth thing. Yeah, I've been through two crowns and I'm in the middle of getting two implants and it's $14,000 lighter in my wallet this year so far. Just a real quick comment and then a question. Wonderful readings this morning. And I had some incredibly significant breakthroughs this morning. And I really, truly understand and believe that I am experiencing a spiritual awakening. I attribute that to some of the retreats. But I've been at this now really seriously for about 3 years where I've really had a dedicated mindfulness practice. And I keep getting distracted all the time. And I have for whatever seems like forever. So I'm wondering, I really have a clear understanding now of the different, there's methodologies to dealing with distractions during the mindfulness practice. And for you, since the chaos in the world is intensifying, have you continued to use what methodology do you use to deal with the distractions? Because I realize now it's going to happen. It always has happened, always will happen. The monkey mind and all these distractions that pull me out of what I would like to feel in my meditation. I've discovered and I'm studying a lot of different methods of dealing with those distractions. So I found a couple of those this morning and it was marvelous. I've had 85 minutes worth of sit time this morning already and practiced that and it's working. What do you use to deal with those distractions?
Well, see, Steve, it's different for you and me. So I've been practicing for 41 years.
Right.
And I think that probably I'm not sure that what I do is the best thing for you to do.
Probably not.
I think it's good for you to keep experimenting for yourself and see what works. It sounds like you're finding some methods. I'm not trying to conceal. I'm perfectly happy to talk about how I practice, but I just want to kind of put that out there first and say that you kind of get an idea how I practice by the way I teach.
Okay.
Which is that I don't focus on methodology. But of course, that doesn't mean I'm not doing something. So what I'm mostly doing, I think, because I don't think about it a lot, but I think that what I mostly am doing is noticing when there's some kind of emotional or mental discomfort. And doing a combination, first of all, like trying to adopt an attitude of non-resistance to that discomfort. That's like my number one thing. So that's different from trying to let go. And it's a critical difference, because if I'm saying, oh, I'm uncomfortable, let me get rid of that, let me let go of that discomfort, what happens to me is that I'm immediately in conflict with it, and that creates more discomfort for me. So what I do first is I try to just be like, okay, this sucks. It's okay. It's unpleasant. I can be with it. I'm not going to fight it. And then I will kind of gently bring the attention more into the body and more into the breath. But it's not with that kind of like turning away or trying to get away or even trying to let go. It's a, okay, you're there and I'm breathing. It's a both and practice rather than a either or practice.
That's exactly what happened. And see, this is incredibly beneficial to me. And that's why you're the teacher and I'm the student. You have 41 years of practice, but that's exactly what I was doing. And it was very effective. It was very freeing.
I think it's a natural place to evolve to in practice. If you do a lot of practice and kind of work with a lot of forms, as I did in the beginning, you know, which is good. It's good to know the forms and understand them and kind of, okay, what's it mean to like note the thoughts, and what's it mean to, I mean, it's kind of like what Jack Kornfield is talking about. It's like you do all these different people's practice, do loving kindness practice, do some kind of emptiness. I don't know what that would mean, but, you know, noting everything or noticing impermanence. And you sort of get that whole landscape. And then you just find your way into something that's organic to you, that works for you. And for some people, I think they can work with form without getting attached. I mean, that's the key, right? And when I say attached, really, I mean, without being aversive, like creating a tension between what you're trying to make your mind do and what it is doing, you know. And it's possible to, you know, to do these very formal practice, structured practices without creating that aversive relationship that I was describing. It wasn't possible for me to do that after a while. I just found that I always would work myself into a corner where I was like fighting with my own mind because I was trying to make it do something it wasn't doing.
And right.
So Chris, I will try to respond to you, but I'm going to have to go very, very shortly.
Cool. So I guess really quickly, I just had a question about how your comment around be who you are, and that it's interesting. It comes up a lot in mindfulness and meditation, and it seems to oddly be at conflict with, you know, someone in recovery whose sort of own, you know, if I just listened to what my mind said when I was right. in my addiction, then right. I'd destroy myself and others. So how do you rectify that?
Well, right. And that's why I kind of backtracked a little bit and said, you know, you've got to have this foundation of sila, of morality. So yeah, I think we have to clear away the Buddhist term would be the obstructions kind of, but like if we're addicts, it's like we have to deal with the primary problem before we even know who we are, because we are, you know, addiction really distorts us. It distorts our mind. It distorts our personality. It distorts our lives. So we don't really know, you know, who we are. Certainly not in a positive sense. And absolutely, I'm talking about being, you know, a manifestation of your positive qualities. What potentials do you have? So absolutely, it starts with, you know, whether it's drugs and alcohol or sex or food or codependence, whatever it is, it's dealing with that first before anything's going to happen. I mean, that's why it says spiritual awakening happens in step 12, right?
Right. And I think this, so I know this will lead to a longer conversation, but I think a lot of people who get through recovery and say, okay, I've got this whole like drug thing down. What else is wrong with me? What other moral impurities are there? And so it can be this like whack-a-mole like process right. of being like, okay, you know, I be yourself except for the moral issues. Okay, one of those was addiction, but there's also this obsessive thinking and mm-hmm. anxiety and depression and all these other right. things. And so how can we make it productive without making it this like Sisyphean task of constantly needing to improve ourselves before we can be whole?
I think the short answer to that is a middle way. And a middle way meaning that we engage as best we can with our meditation practice, with therapy, with recovery program, and things that linger and that we see are, you know, very persistent and seem to sort of define us in some way. Those things, as long as we're not harming others, first of all, then we try to make friends with them in a certain way and see that, oh, that's just like, yeah, I tend to get irritable in these situations, or I, you know, yeah, a lot of thinking gets triggered and anxiety gets triggered. Okay, can I breathe with that? Can I accept that? Can I, you know, so there's this, on the one hand, trying to bring sort of therapeutic modalities and spiritual modalities to bear in dealing with this stuff. But then on the other hand, saying, yeah, but I'm never going to be the perfect person. So, you know, at some point I have to accept that, like, I'm kind of, it's like doing the best I can, you know, but it's never going to be perfect. But it is a longer conversation and I do have to go. So thanks to everybody for coming.